Good morning. It's time again for the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you these headlines for the 21st of April, Tuesday, from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Cook to step down at Apple. Warsh embarks on tricky path for Fed job. Owners allege Tesla misled on self-driving. That first headline is by Rolf Winkler. Cook to step down at Apple. CEO to move up to executive chairman in September hands the reins to insider Turnus. Tim Cook, the longtime leader of Apple, is stepping down after transforming the iPhone maker into a titan of the technology industry, handing the reins to a veteran engineer. The company said Monday that John Turnus will take over as CEO, elevating an affable mechanical engineer and 25-year veteran of the company's hardware division. Turnus, 50 years old, takes the lead of Apple as it works to rekindle its creative fire and chart a hardware-heavy future in the AI area. He follows Steve Jobs, who led the invention of the most popular consumer product in history, and Cook, who squeezed so much profit from the device that Apple became the world's most valuable company. His appointment will take effect September the 1st, when Cook will become executive chairman, succeeding longtime chair Art Levinson. Cook, 65, will be remembered for creating immense value. During his tenure, Apple's market capitalization grew by nearly $3.7 trillion to about $4 trillion, surpassing the value created by any other American CEO in total dollars, save NVIDIA's Jensen Huang. Known for deft politicking inside the company, Turnus had been widely seen as the leading candidate to succeed Cook. As a top hardware executive, he worked on the iPad, then later the Mac and AirPods, before taking over responsibility for all of Apple's products, including its most important, the iPhone. John is a deep collaborator, said Chris Deaver, a former Apple human resources staffer who worked with him. Having a great product leader at the helm right now is a good future indicator for Apple. A key question for Turnus is how he can help Apple maintain its dominance at a time when most of its rivals are investing hundreds of billions of dollars into computing infrastructure and embedding cutting-edge artificial intelligence tools into their products and daily workflows. Recent company moves have offered a hint at its strategy. Turnus has little experience with AI, and the company has fallen behind rivals in developing and releasing frontier models. It's not out of the race entirely, however, as iPhones are still a primary way consumers access AI apps. The company's App Store AI revenue is set to top $1 billion this year simply by collecting subscription fees from companies such as OpenAI. Analysts see that role expanding as Apple prepares to release an overhauled version of its Siri assistant later this year. AI providers who want to reach users of the 2.5 billion active Apple devices in circulation will have to pay Apple handsomely, a likelihood expected to give the company more time to create new AI solutions that can work without the massive computing costs its peers are facing. Turnus will also need to revive Apple's spirit of innovation, which some critics feel has been lost under Cook. Company's most successful products since the iPhone are AirPods earbuds and the Apple Watch, which are big businesses on their own, yet pale next to the iPhone. Other efforts have been less successful. The Vision Pro headset has been a sales dud. A project to build a self-driving car was killed after the company spent billions of dollars on its development. One of Turnus's central accomplishments was working with Apple's in-house silicon team to replace Intel chips inside Mac computers with chips designed by Apple itself. The chips proved more energy efficient and Mac sales soared after the change, which came in 2020. Turnus is known inside Apple for his even demeanor and engineering competence. He's helped lead a redesign of Apple's iPhone lineup, one that began with so-called liquid glass software revamp and continued with the iPhone Air last year and a foldable device expected late in the fall. Apple has raised Ternus's profile of late, allowing him to unveil the iPhone Air at its annual iPhone event. Cook is likely to be remembered as one of the most consequential chief executives in the history of capitalism, a master of the supply chain who found novel ways to squeeze more value from the iPhone and expand its base of users. Through much of his years leading Apple, he had an almost monistic commitment to the company, waking up before 4 a.m. to review global sales data. He also met with top staff on Fridays, a meeting some called Date Night with Tim because it stretched late into the evening. Over his tenure, he navigated Apple through countless political controversies in the U.S. and abroad, establishing a style of personal CEO diplomacy with world leaders from Barack Obama to President Trump and China's Xi Jinping. In recent years, as U.S. politics have been defined by severe polarization, Cook has stressed the value of engaging on important issues, especially when people disagree. Cook spoke often about Apple's values. In 2014, he came out as gay, saying he decided to do so in the interest of the greater good, despite his general desire for privacy. On many occasions, Cook has harked back to the advice he received from Jobs before he died in 2011, when the Apple co-founder famously told his successor, "Never ask what he would do, and just do what's right." In the long arc of time, people change their mind on companies, but we've always suited up and fought, Cook said at a Wall Street Journal event shortly after he took the helm. "Our North Star is always on making the best products." And that's Cook to step down at Apple. Our next headline, Warsh embarks on tricky path for Fed job, challenges how he can manage what Trump expects with what he can deliver. This is by Nick Timoreos. Wall Street and Washington will be watching Kevin Warsh on Tuesday for any sign he has an understanding with President Trump to cut interest rates if installed as a chair of the Federal Reserve. Trump will be watching for any sign he doesn't. The Highwire Act starts before Warsh even has the job. Warsh secured the nomination by convincing Trump he shares the president's view that the Fed should be cutting rates. At his Senate confirmation hearing, he can reaffirm that case at a moment when the Iran war has turned economic conditions against it, or begin carefully to distance himself from it. Air cover from Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who last week said he understood why the war has made the Fed hesitant to cut, might have helped Warsh, but Trump publicly overruled Bessent one day later, saying he didn't agree. Warsh has said almost nothing in public about monetary policy in 5 months, since before he was selected for the job. He broke the silence Monday, saying in prepared remarks for his hearing that the Fed's independence isn't threatened when elected officials state their views on interest rates. But he also warned that continued inflation would raise public doubts about whether monetary policy independence is worth preserving. The world has changed since the president and Kevin and any other Fed candidate may have talked, said Glenn Hubbard, the present Republican economist who served with Warsh under President George W. Bush. "Bringing colleagues along is Warsh's job," he said. "It's hard to believe that consensus would be around an immediate rate cut, just given the state of the world." Jerome Powell, the outgoing chair, approached Trump's pressure for lower rates through a posture of stoic non-engagement. The circumstances were also different when Trump picked Powell 8 years ago. In the run-up to Powell's confirmation, there was no publicly stated expectation by Trump that Powell was going to deliver a particular course of monetary policy. By contract, Warsh's path to the job ran through a series of conversations in which Trump, a Republican, repeatedly indicated that whomever he chose would deliver what Powell hadn't, and Warsh didn't just inherit the expectation Trump now holds, he helped set them. On Fox Business last October, Warsh guessed the Fed as the wet blanket on an administration trying to deliver a golden age. "It's very dangerous when two parts of our government are working at cross purposes. It's got to change," he said. Warsh laid out an ambitious agenda for his chairmanship. He said that the Fed talks too much about the near-term path of rates and leans too heavily on backward-looking data. He also has said it plays too large a role in overnight lending markets after expanding its footprint during the 2008-2009 financial crisis. Whether this will matter to the White House if rates aren't coming down is another matter. Asked last week on Fox Business whether interest rates would still fall this year, Trump responded, "When Kevin gets in, I do." 1 week before he announced Warsh as his pick, Trump described candidates for the job as people who tend to say everything I want to hear in interviews and then change their views. "It's amazing how people change once they have the job," he said. "It's too bad, sort of disloyalty, but they've got to do what they think is right." Investors are watching closely because Warsh's views on monetary policy have moved in opposite ways over the past 2 years. In 2024 and early last year, Warsh was critical of the Fed for being too comfortable accepting 3% inflation, implying that the Fed shouldn't be lowering rates. But last summer, he said the Fed was too worried about inflation. That absence of detail of what his views are is probably the most important thing for investors. "They're just looking for a rationale for the change in views," said Brian Gardner, Washington policy strategist at Stifel. What is his thought process? How did he get from A to B to C? People who have worked with Warsh said his conviction about the role of a central bank and an eye on his historical legacy would pull him toward independence and not the president. The Fed chair who bent to a president's demand for easy money, Arthur Burns, in the early 1970s under President Richard Nixon, is remembered for nourishing a decade of inflation. The more immediate question is whether Warsh can survive his first months in office without the tirades and confrontation Powell endured. "Working relationships between presidents and Fed chairs aren't uncommon," said Ellen Mead, a former Fed economist now at Duke University, "and Warsh has maintained a stronger social relationship with Trump than Powell ever had. Warsh might be well placed to try to thread that a little bit," she said. Others have been critical of Powell's approach. They said his habit of invoking the institution's independence and stance of non-engagement made some collisions with Trump worse than they had to be. A chair who visited the White House, flattered the president, gave him a sense of being heard, they say, could buy room that Powell never had without necessarily compromising on policy. The approach has skeptics. "The job of the Fed chair isn't to be a Trump whisperer or any president whisperer," said Hubbard, the Republican economist. "The Fed has legal protections to preserve a central bank that's both independent and seen that way," he said, "which should reduce any need to cultivate a relationship with the president." And that's Warsh embarks on tricky path for Fed job. Our next article is by Becky Peterson, "Owners Allege Tesla Misled on Self-Driving." When Tom LoSavio bought his Tesla Model S in 2017, he thought he was buying a car that would one day drive itself. The retired attorney and self-described early adapter paid more than $100,000 for the luxury sedan, including $8,000 for lifetime access to its most advanced driver assistance features. Tesla chief executive Elon Musk said the hardware in the company's car would eventually allow all of its cars to drive themselves. "My wife and I talked about what a great thing it would be if we could just get in a car and have it drive us places," LoSavio told the Wall Street Journal. In the 9 years since LoSavio said, it's become clear Tesla took him for a ride. He's the lead plaintiff in a class-action lawsuit that alleges that Tesla charged customers thousands of dollars in pricey upgrades for a product that didn't and still doesn't exist. LoSavio alleges Musk and Tesla have made repeated claims that were false about the self-driving capabilities of these vehicles and misled consumers who paid extra because they believe the company's marketing. His lawsuit is one of several ongoing efforts by Tesla owners looking to hold the company accountable for overpromising and underdelivering on its full self-driving supervised product. In the Netherlands, a Tesla owner launched a campaign last week to organize European buyers, some who paid thousands for automated driving technology but still lack access because of local regulations. A law firm in Australia has also assembled a class action case accusing the company of misleading customers about the car's capabilities. The matter calls into question Musk's decade-long marketing pitch that Tesla's autonomous vehicles were just around the corner. That promise kept Tesla's stock near all-time highs and with a market cap that exceeds most other automakers combined, even as its share of the electric vehicle market has eroded. Tesla and its lawyers didn't respond to requests to comment. The issue of Hardware 3, as the outdated hardware is known, has taken on a life of its own online, with owners talking to Reddit and Facebook to complain about Tesla's inaction. Investors also frequently ask Tesla executives about the matter on quarterly earnings calls. The lawsuits and the European campaign represent just thousands of Tesla customers. Wall Street analysts, however, estimate there are millions of Teslas with the outdated hardware no longer capable of running the most sophisticated version of Tesla's full self-driving supervised software. By all appearances, the company is closer than ever to its goal. Its new robo-taxi ride-hailing service offers a small number of driverless rides in Austin, Texas, along with Dallas and Houston. Tesla has said it would come to more cities in the coming months. The company has also said it plans to start production on the Cyber Cab, a two-seat coupe that Musk has said won't need a steering wheel or pedals. Still, for drivers like Lo Savio, it isn't clear how or when Tesla will make good on the most ambitious of its promises, that most Teslas on the road today will one day be capable of autonomy. You want to believe that, you're not a fool, Lo Savio said. Lo Savio, 80 years old, lives in a Tony suburb on the San Francisco Peninsula. He's seeking a refund for himself and other Tesla customers who bought or leased new Teslas between 2016 and 2024 and paid extra for add-ons with the expectation that the cars would eventually become autonomous. The lawsuit also aims to bar Tesla from marketing its products as self-driving. Lo Savio won class action status for his suit in September. The class represents approximately 3,000 people in California, a figure that excludes the many Tesla owners who've signed arbitration agreements with the company that prevent them from suing. Now, Tesla is appealing the suit's class action certification, leaving it up to a Ninth Circuit judge as to whether Lo Savio can represent the class as is with modifications or whether he'll have to pursue the lawsuit alone. At the center of the suit are the hardware within Tesla vehicles that automate certain driving tasks, such as steering, braking, and acceleration, under close human supervision and the claims Tesla made for years about those capabilities. Tesla's vehicles are equipped with cameras and onboard computers and previously ultrasonic sensors and radar that enable those functions. Today, Tesla's most advanced driver assist features are sold as a $99 monthly subscription under the name Full Self-Driving Supervised. FSD can navigate most streets, change lanes, and park while supervised by a driver who must keep eyes on the road and periodically touch the steering wheel. Tesla started including early versions of this tech in its vehicles in 2014. By 2015, Musk was claiming Tesla vehicles could drive themselves entirely within 2 years. Then in 2016, Tesla announced that all new cars built from then on had the hardware required for full self-driving. Musk told the media that a Tesla would drive itself from Los Angeles to New York City by the end of 2017. I feel pretty good about this goal, he said. Will be able to demonstrate drive of full autonomy all the way from LA to New York. That prediction didn't come true. Eventually, Tesla's plans required a more sophisticated computer and cameras than were installed in Lo Savio's car. In 2020 and 2021, it started offering customers upgrades to the third edition of its computer and camera set. Some customers, like Lo Savio, who paid up front for lifetime access, get free upgrades from Tesla. Others who wanted to use FSD but paid monthly could pay $1,000 for the upgrade. Then, in 2023, Tesla upgraded its hardware for the fourth time and started selling new cars with its latest chip. That meant that Customers like Losavio, who got updated to the third edition computer a few years ago, once again had outdated equipment. Tesla hasn't made any moves since January 2025, when Musk told investors that the company would have to upgrade the computer for customers who bought the lifetime full self-driving package. Earlier that month, Tesla had released its first major update to FSD in a year. Musk teased further updates to the software, saying that soon your car will feel like it's sentient. This update, however, only worked on cars with the latest hardware, leaving some U.S. customers with older versions of the system. Already, Musk has started talking up the potential of new generations of hardware. And that's owners allege Tesla misled on self-driving. Our next article, High Costs Drive Away Florida's Middle Class. This is by Arian Campo Flores and Paul Overberg, Orlando, Florida. Florida's migration patterns are changing dramatically. Residents in their prime working years are headed to other states, often citing affordability concerns. At the same time, the stream of people arriving from other states is shrinking. Meanwhile, an influx of wealthy people from other states, turbocharged during the pandemic, has helped drive up home prices. Inflation in parts of Florida outpaced the national average over the past decade, and home insurance rates soared. These side-by-side trends could spell trouble for a state whose economy relies on continued population growth and real estate development. The affordability picture has changed in Florida almost more than anywhere else in the country, said Eric Finnegan, Vice President of Demographics Research at John Burns Research and Consulting. Florida lost one driver of population growth when deaths began to outnumber births in the state in 2020. Large flows of immigration fueled gains for years, but have waned under the Trump administration's hardline policies. Despite the influx of wealth, net domestic migration, people arriving from other states minus those leaving to other states, has overall slowed to a trickle in the past few years. Stoking the change is a mismatch between the soaring cost of living in Florida and middling wages that haven't kept up. Roberto Reyes became fed up with rising rents and other spiraling costs in Orlando and jumped at a job offer as an insurance agent in Knoxville, Tennessee last July. He's now paying $2,300 a month for a two-bedroom apartment with a garage in an amenity-rich complex, $150 less than what he paid for a one-bedroom in downtown Orlando. He isn't spending nearly as much for entertainment and eating out. And his commission-based income climbed to $226,000 in the 7 months he's been in Knoxville, he said, far exceeding the $137,000 he earned in his best full year in Orlando. "I came here to grow to the next level," Reyes, 39 years old, said. "I couldn't be happier." Among the 25 most populous metro areas in the U.S., Orlando, Miami, and Tampa ranked among the bottom five for median household income in 2024, according to a U.S. Census Bureau report last year. The changing affordability situation has led to a shrinking supply of working-age newcomers who are key to filling jobs and stoking demand for housing, retail, and services. Florida depends heavily on such sectors as it lacks big industries that generate an abundance of high-paying jobs. Though affluent arrivals generate economic benefits such as higher tax collections, the broader trend is a concern. The collapse in domestic migration is a direct threat to jobs and paychecks for the state's current residents, Finnegan said. It's also a potential hit to home values and those with their wealth tied up in home equity. Migration powered Florida's economy for decades as the state lured people with its sunshine lifestyle and once affordable housing. Since 2019, that flow has been ebbing in the Miami area, where surging housing and other costs have led to a net loss of residents. Miami and other parts of South Florida have drawn a wave of wealthy newcomers who've juiced the economy with demand for high-end construction and services, but their arrival hasn't stemmed a sharp slowdown in job growth in the Miami area or outright declines in high-income employment in areas such as financial activities and professional and business services, according to data from John Burns Research and Consulting. The drop-off in domestic migration is now spreading to other parts of the state, according to an analysis of U.S. Census Bureau data by the Wall Street Journal. Metro areas, including Orlando, Naples, and Panama City, experienced net losses of domestic migrants in 2024. The net losses often were clustered in lower age groups, mainly those 44 and under. Comparing population flows in 2024 to those in 2019 showed that even though some other metro areas are still getting more domestic migrants than they're losing, the size of the gains has dropped significantly. That was the case in metro areas including Tampa, Sarasota, and Cape Coral, according to the analysis. Sydney Buckley and her husband, Rene Barajas Jr., moved out of the West Palm Beach area last September, paying $2,000 a month to rent a one-bedroom apartment. They searched for a house to buy, but couldn't find any within their budget. After researching cities around the country that were affordable and offered a good work-life balance, the couple decided to move to Greenville, South Carolina. They bought a newly built home for $355,000 with a monthly mortgage payment only $100 more than what they were spending on rent. They pay much less in property taxes and insurance than what they would have faced in Florida. Their combined income of about $160,000 a year from her work as a speech pathologist and his and as an employment coordinator stretches further in Greenville, allowing them to dine out regularly and vacation abroad. "We have more disposable income here," Buckley, 31, said. A poll last year by Florida Atlantic University's Business and Economics Polling Initiative found that 80% of Florida residents were concerned about housing affordability and 43% said they lived paycheck to paycheck. Nearly half said they'd considered leaving Florida because of the cost of living. Of the 20 most common occupations in the state, 13 paid on average less than $20 an hour, including retail salespeople, cashiers, and cooks, according to a 2025 study by United Way of Florida. Soaring home prices, together with other factors like elevated mortgage rates, have depressed the housing market. In Tampa, the median sale price of homes was $478,000 in February, compared with $298,000 5 years earlier, according to brokerage Redfin. The Orlando area workforce remains disproportionately concentrated in lower-wage occupations, according to a 2025 report by the Orlando Economic Partnership. Younger residents are leaving the state, likely due to the cost considerations, and being replaced by older arrivals less attached to the labor force, the report said. Carrie Jo Davis, 34, left the Orlando area after working as an event operations coordinator at the ESPN Wide World of Sports complex, earning about $40,000 a year. He said he split the rent on a house with roommates, paying $750 a month. In 2024, he landed a job with the Montgomery Biscuits, a minor league baseball team in Alabama, as an equipment manager. He's now earning $45,000 a year, and his living costs are much lower. The team provides housing during the season. Davis said he sometimes thinks about returning to Orlando. "I definitely miss it," he said, "but I would definitely have to crunch the numbers." And that's high costs drive away Florida's middle class. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sunsounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Sunsounds of Arizona programming like the Wall Street Journal, either as it streams or at a time of your choosing, by going to the Sunsounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sunsounds of Arizona app. You can get that at the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And you can listen to Sunsounds of Arizona programming streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. Turn now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal for these headlines. Senators warn United American on merger. Struggling Spirit Air is in talks for federal investment. And Red Lobster's Endless Shrimp is coming back. That first article, Senators warn United American on merger. Carriers asked to share how possible tie-up could affect routes and fares. This is by Jacob Passy. Democrat and Republican senators are raising concerns that a merger between United Airlines and American Airlines could harm travelers. In a letter to United Chief Executive Scott Kirby and American CEO Robert Isom, the senator said a potential deal could result in higher airfares and a reduction in flights and markets that both airlines serve. A combined United American would represent the world's largest airline in several metrics, including passengers served. A combined United American air carrier would be able to exploit its market power to harm consumers in a number of ways, according to the letter from Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, and Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, a copy of which was viewed by the Wall Street Journal. United declined to comment. American referred to its Friday statement in which the company said it's not engaged with or interested in any discussions regarding a merger with United. American, based in Fort Worth, Texas, also argued that such a merger would harm competition and consumers. The letter reflects the blowback that both carriers have received since reports last week suggested that Kirby had proposed a potential merger to President Trump. The senators asked the two companies to provide information about any discussions they've had regarding merging and any analysis of how the deal could affect airfares, routes, and employees. The airlines were asked to respond by May the 3rd. United's Kirby has argued that U.S. carriers need to grow to compete with other international airlines that receive state funding. The surge in jet fuel costs has raised the likelihood of consolidation in the airline sector, according to industry analysts. Lee, one of the letter's signatories, serves as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee on Antitrust, Competition Policy, and Consumer Rights. Other recent industry partnerships have faced lawsuits from state attorneys general. Such a deal could also attract lawsuits from customers, which could block it from coming to fruition. The two airlines had recently battled over gates at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport. The Federal Aviation Administration said Thursday that it would be reducing the number of flights there this summer by 12%. Before he was hired by United, Kirby served as American's president, but was later pushed out. And that's Senators Warn United American on Merger. Our next article, Struggling Spirit Air is in talks for federal investment. This is by Allison Sider and Brian Schwartz. Spirit Airline is looking for a lifeline from the Trump administration. The administration and the troubled discount carrier are in talks about government aid, including a potential U.S. government investment into the company, people familiar with the discussion said. Spirit filed for bankruptcy protection in August after a previous bankruptcy filing in late 2024 didn't resolve its financial struggles. Discount airlines have been under pressure for years, with bigger rivals such as Delta Airlines, United Airlines Holdings, and American Airlines Group offering their own basic economy fares, along with more exotic destinations and premium upgrades. Florida-based Spirit has been working to sell some planes and refocus operations on core cities, including Orlando, Fort Lauderdale, and Detroit. In February, the carrier reached an agreement with a group of creditors that would let it emerge as a smaller company with a stronger balance sheet and reduced fleet size. Then came the U.S. and Israel's war on Iran, which led jet fuel prices to more than double in a matter of weeks. If jet fuel prices remain elevated for the rest of the year, Spirit's costs would balloon by $360 million. JP Morgan analysts said in a note earlier this month. Spirit had $704.9 million in cash at the end of February, just before jet fuel prices started climbing, according to a court filing last week. The lenders that backed Spirit's revolving credit line objected earlier this month to the company's bankruptcy exit plan, saying it might not work if fuel prices remain high. The Transportation Department has said it's monitoring Spirit's situation and blamed the failures of the last administration for the airline's financial stress. The discussions were reported earlier by the Air Current. Bloomberg earlier reported Spirit had proposed offering the government an equity stake in the company. And that's struggling Spirit Air is in talks for federal investment. Next, we have Red Lobster's Endless Shrimp is coming back. This is by Heather Haddon. Red Lobster's bringing back its famed Endless Shrimp promotion with a few strings attached. The seafood chain said Monday it was reviving the deal for the first time since it declared bankruptcy in 2024. Adding Endless Shrimp to the permanent menu was among the factors that pushed Red Lobster into bankruptcy. But executives said Monday the chain was bombarded with requests from shellfish lovers for big plates of shrimp on the cheap. "When our fans talk, we listen," Red Lobster chief executive Damolia Adam Olakum said. Unlike the promotion's previous iteration, this time around Red Lobster plans to offer Endless Shrimp on a limited time basis at participating locations. The chain won't serve it to go, for delivery, or on holidays. The deal starts at $24.99 in some areas, a bit more than the previous version, according to advertisements for the deal in some markets. Nearly 2 years since its bankruptcy, Red Lobster's turnaround remains a work in progress. Adam Olakum said earlier this year that sales are returning but remain challenged. Executives are gunning to renegotiate leases, which could help the chain close more stores and reduce its costs. The company's U.S. sales across its 520 domestic locations fell to $1.6 billion last year, down 6% from 2024 levels, according to market research firm Technomic. Red Lobster has thrown its periodic Endless Shrimp party since the early 2000s. The chain that ran it roughly annually and restricted the types of shrimp that customers could get. "Every year, I guess, count the days in anticipation of Endless Shrimp," Red Lobster said, while promoting the deal in 2019 when it sold for $15.99. Seafood supplier Thai Union, Red Lobster's previous majority owner, started to supercharge the deal in 2021, with Ultimate Endless Shrimp. It ran the promotion more often and included more expensive varieties, like hand-breaded shrimp tossed in coconut. Thai Union launched the $20 all-you-can-eat shrimp deal as a permanent menu item in 2023 to try to stimulate sales growth after a long slump. Some customers started showing up with takeout containers to fill for home, and restaurant staff were stressed out by the promotion. The deal generated heavy sales for Thai Union, but it wrecked Red Lobster's profit, contributing to an $11 million quarterly loss for the chain. Thai Union divested its holding in Red Lobster in early 2024. That's Red Lobster's Endless Shrimp is coming back. Our next article, Running Robot Lifts Industry's Pace. This is by Raphael Huang. Singapore. A year ago in Beijing's humanoid robot half-marathon race, the first runner to cross the finish line took more than 2.5 hours. In this year's event, the champion beat the fastest human ever. Sunday's race demonstrated China's rapid progress in humanoid robotics, a field American tech leaders, including NVIDIA's Jensen Huang and Tesla's Elon Musk, say is the next big thing. The winner was a humanoid called Lightning, developed by Chinese smartphone maker Honor. Still, it wasn't a perfect race. About 220 yards from the finish line, Lightning slammed into a barricade and collapsed. The robot managed to get back on its feet with help from humans and ran across the finish line in 50 minutes and 26 seconds, according to state media. Last month, the human world record holder, Jacob Kip Limo from Uganda finished the roughly 13-mile race in 57 minutes and 20 seconds in Lisbon, Portugal. Lightning and two siblings from Honor swept the podium. All three navigated the course without human control, excluding the one-time help the champion got. The race penalized the completion times of those relying on constant human remote control, including one that finished the race in under 50 minutes, according to the organizer. Tiang Kong Ultra, developed by Beijing-based Lab X Humanoid and last year's winner, more than halved its finish time this year, clocking in at 1 hour and 15 minutes without human intervention. The course included more complex terrain than last year, such as slopes, narrow passages and sharp turns, and serving as an extreme stress test, said Ying Wang, a tech analyst at Bernstein Research. A favorite from China's Una Tree collapsed several times and was taken off the track on a stretcher. Honor, which was spun off from Huawei in 2020 and started developing humanoid robots last year, said its expertise in consumer electronics accelerated its development of humanoids. An Honor engineer said its robot used liquid cooling technology adapted from its phones, according to state media. Last year's race saw human operators manually applying cooling spray to prevent joints from overheating. The Lightning robot draws on high-precision satellite positioning systems to stay on course, according to state media. And that's Running Robot Lifts Industry's Pace. Next, we turn to Anthropic, Amazon tighten their bond. And this is by Sean McLean and Kate Clark. Amazon said Monday that it would invest an additional $5 billion in Anthropic, part of a broadening partnership that will see the two tech companies collaborate more closely. Amazon said its total investment could be as high as $25 billion if the partnership hits certain commercial milestones. As part of the agreement, Anthropic, which has increasingly been hampered by a shortage of the computing power needed to serve its popular artificial intelligence models, agreed to purchase more than $100 billion of Amazon's cloud services. Anthropic said it would make use of 5 gigawatts worth of Amazon AI chips as part of the agreement. The investment comes as competition in the AI industry heats up ahead of the expected public offerings of Anthropic and its rival, OpenAI. Amazon is rapidly expanding spending on new data centers and chip designs. The company has said that it would spend $200 billion on capital expenditures this year, much of it on AI-related investments, including new data centers. The pace of investment has led some analysts to question whether Amazon could justify the spending with enough new business. Amazon shares rose nearly 3% in after-hours trading on Monday. Amazon's partnership with Anthropic started in 2023 when the e-commerce and cloud computing giant invested $4 billion in the AI startup. Today, Anthropic is both a strategic investment and a key customer for Amazon Web Services and the company's AI chips dubbed Trainium. In October, Amazon opened one of the largest AI data centers for Anthropic in Indiana called Project Rainier, which is powered by 500,000 Trainium 2 chips. Ultimately, that number is set to double, Amazon has said. The added computing capacity would help relieve pressure on Anthropic, recently valued at $380 billion, as demand for its AI models surges. The company has faced a computing power crunch that has led to outages, throttling, and slower performance for its Claude AI model. Some customers have opted to switch to other AI models out of frustration with the disruptions, the journal has reported. Earlier this month, Anthropic also expanded its partnership with Alphabet's Google and Broadcom, adding multiple gigawatts of capacity on their TPU chips. Recent months have seen rapid growth of the company's coding tool, Claude Code. Anthropic said this month that its revenue run rate had reached $30 billion, far exceeding its earlier expectations for the year. In a statement, Anthropic Chief Executive Dario Amodei said the company needs to build the infrastructure to keep pace with rapidly growing demand. And that's Anthropic, Amazon, Titan, their bond. Next, we have an article by Patrick Thomas and Aaron Mulvaney. These cancer victims could sink Bayer's Roundup settlement. The clock was ticking for Philip Dressel to make a decision that could mean life-changing money. Dressel is one of roughly 200,000 plaintiffs who have sued Bayer, claiming that its weed killer Roundup caused their cancer. The 69-year-old former landscaper with a rare form of non-Hodgkin lymphoma could join a $7.5 billion settlement reached earlier this year. His other option was proceeding with his individual case against Bayer. The settlement could bring Dressel at least $48,000. A jury verdict, his lawyers estimate, could bring a payout totaling millions of dollars. He had to make a decision by June the 4th. Opting to go it alone is risky. Roughly two-thirds of the 28 Roundup trials so far have ended in a loss for plaintiffs. It might get harder going forward. The Supreme Court on April 27th will hear a case brought by Bayer in the company's effort to narrow the volume of Roundup claims it's facing. Bayer wants anyone with a claim to join the settlement and put an end to a litigation nightmare that's hung over it since its 2018 acquisition of Monsanto, the inventor of Roundup. Bayer has denied Roundup causes cancer and said that the product is safe to use, citing numerous regulatory reviews. A Bayer spokesman said the settlement is fair to all parties and would provide significant compensation to current and future claimants. But Dressel wants to hold Bayer accountable and for the company to admit that it marketed a potentially dangerous product. He's decided to roll the dice and take Bayer to trial. They screwed up, basically. And when you screw up, you got to be accountable, he said. The potential settlement is Bayer's latest attempt to end the mass litigation it faces for the weed killer and fend off future lawsuits. The case has echoes of similar proposed deals with 3M, Johnson & Johnson, and Purdue Pharma. But getting such a deal done can be hard and fractious among the thousands of alleged victims who have to decide if the settlement offers fair compensation. With Bayer, a group of lawyers representing roughly 40,000 claimants negotiated privately with the company over 18 months to design the settlement plan. The $7.5 billion settlement received preliminary approval from a Missouri state judge in March to proceed. The proposed settlement would bring Bayer's total price tag to resolve the Roundup litigation to roughly $22 billion. While the number of cases has mounted, Bayer has explored strategic options, including a potential bankruptcy filing, to curb its Roundup litigation costs. The company's lobbied state legislatures and sought other relief to limit its exposure from a torrent of cases. The company wants to get as many plaintiffs as possible into the settlement. The opt-outs need to be something approaching zero, Chief Executive Bill Anderson said in a March investor call. People opt out, then you really don't have an agreement, and then we would have to move on to other potential solutions. But the plan has divided plaintiffs' lawyers since it was announced. Critics of the settlement said the process was rushed and won't adequately compensate victims. The proposed requirements for proving Roundup exposure and age limitations are unfair, they said. If Bayer prevails in the case before the Supreme Court, it could help lead to the dismissal of thousands of cases against the company. Eric Holland, a lawyer who represents a few thousand plaintiffs, sees that as a strong reason for plaintiffs to take the settlement deal. The situation is dire, he said. One of the skeptics among the plaintiffs, Wagstaff Law Firm, recently switched its position in support of the deal last month, a sign that opposition is narrowing. For Dressel, the case is about adequate compensation and hearing Bayer take responsibility. He said he sprayed gallons of Roundup almost every week in his more than 20 years working as a landscaper. It was the best stuff, he said, to clear yards and sidewalks of weeds. Dressel didn't question using it until 2023 when he noticed skin lesions forming on his arms. A biopsy revealed cancer. Dressel says he hasn't been able to work in the past 2 years. Medical procedures, including a left leg amputation and tumor removal from his skull, cost him hundreds of thousands of dollars, a sum surpassing what the potential settlement might yield. He now spends most days hooked up to an IV machine at his small apartment outside of Orlando, Florida. David Selby II, an attorney who represents Dressel and other Roundup cancer plaintiffs, said he's working to get him a trial as soon as possible. Dressel said he isn't looking to get hundreds of millions of dollars, but enough to stay alive. "I'm not trying to be a jerk," he said. "You need a little something, you know. I've got to continue living." And that's "These Cancer Victims Could Sink Bayer's Roundup Settlement." Turn now to the Heard on the Street page of the Wall Street Journal. And our first item is small banks are gaining on giant rivals. Regional lender shares have been boosted by business loan growth. Shares of smaller banks, unloved by investors in recent years, have been enjoying a rare period in their favor, may still have some time to run. At the start of this year, mid-sized bank stocks were roaring back versus their larger peers after 2 years of deep underperformance. The KBW NASDAQ Regional Banking Index, which tracks 50 banks, all with assets under $100 billion, is more than 11% higher so far this year. The KBW NASDAQ Bank Index includes the giant U.S. Wall Street megabanks and several of the biggest U.S. regional lenders, many of which are essentially nationwide banks. That index is up 4% this year. But in April, the larger bank index has narrowed its underperformance. The biggest banks have just been through a strong earnings season, showing that they grew bigger, more profitable, and more confident in their borrowers. Regional and mid-sized banks are still in the process of reporting. Plus, bigger banks are still trading at a sizable premium. S&P 500 banks trade at roughly 20% price-to-book premium relative to S&P Mid-Cap 400 banks, according to FactSet data. While that's down from a peak of over 30%, mid-cap banks had been ones trading at a premium through the 2010s and all the way until 2024. "I think there's staying power to the premium," said KBW head of U.S. banking research, Chris McGrady. "The biggest banks have built more stable, diversified businesses. That gets rewarded in the form of higher valuations." Big Wall Street banks' trading revenue has been on sharp ascent in recent years. Meanwhile, smaller banks' stronghold in commercial and industrial lending to companies where they have actually grown as a share of the market overall became a weakness. Loan growth in this category was weak. While consumers powered through political and price uncertainty, many mid-sized or smaller businesses put off decisions while major policies like tariffs remained in flux. At the same time, the larger Wall Street-oriented banks were seeing a surge in lending to other non-bank lenders such as private asset funds and financial technology companies. However, for the first time in years, the momentum may be shifting. Commercial and industrial loan growth is finally picking up again. The market's view of the relative riskiness of financing other lenders has, meanwhile, grown. A pullback in private lending also could open up more space for bank-led lending and financing. So far this earnings season, some banks with big businesses lending to regional or mid-sized companies have given more upbeat outlooks. For example, Cincinnati-based Fifth Third, one of the so-called super regionals that's in the larger bank KBW NASDAQ Bank Index, told analysts that it saw the strongest lending activity in manufacturing and construction, supported by reshoring and infrastructure investment. A pickup in business borrowing would also put lenders in a better spot with regards to interest rates. Often, mid-sized banks are more exposed to the downside of rising rates because their deposits can be less sticky than big banks, so their costs can rise more than the interest earned on their assets. Expectations for further rate cuts were set to be a benefit to smaller banks, explaining some of their performance pickup into this year. Importantly, though, a lot of typical commercial loans carry floating interest rates rather than fixed ones, so a pickup in this kind of lending could help offset any renewed pressure on deposit costs. There is another factor for mid-sized bank stocks, too, bids from acquirers. A long-anticipated wave of consolidation among banks has, like other deals, likely been slowed by the conflict in the Middle East and market volatility. It could resume. Bank deals are quiet but not forgotten, Wells Fargo banking analysts wrote in a note earlier this month. As the saying goes, if you can't beat them, maybe you can join them. This article was by Telos Demos. Small banks are gaining on giant rivals. Our last item, the Iran relief bounce. Is this time different? We may not have time for all of this, but the last time stocks acted like this, George Bush was president. George H.W. Bush, that is. The tech-heavy NASDAQ Composite Index's 13th consecutive gain on Friday is just one of several unusual features of the Iran relief rally. There is a difference, though, between something being a rarity in traders' playbooks and them needing to order a whole new one. Markets have been acting oddly since the COVID-19 plunge, and there might be structural reasons for that. Before the pandemic, a rebound from a steep sell-off usually was followed by a retest of prior lows. Chris Watling, chief market strategist at Longview Economics, looked back decades at 15 similar non-bear market episodes and found that was the case almost 80% of the time. Since 2020, though, no sharp pullbacks have matched that pattern. One theory he has is the growing importance of multi-strat pod shops. These are huge hedge funds that contain several smaller funds. They use borrowed money and have risk managers who keep them on a tight leash. When returns suddenly turn negative, the pods are forced to take their lumps quickly and reduce risk. That provides a clean slate for the ensuing bounce. There's another big change that might be even more profound, a huge increase in retail trader participation. Millions of brokerage accounts were opened in 2020 and 2021, largely by young men in a perfect storm of commission-free trading, boredom, stimulus checks, and face-ripping volatility. They've become a force. Charles Schwab, chief investment strategist Lizanne Saunders, said on the Excess Returns podcast last week that this cohort, one she distinguishes from other traditional individual investors, makes up a substantial chunk of stock trading many days. Combine their buy-the-dip, chase-the-rip behavior with professional investors like commodity trading advisors, who already followed momentum strategies and bounces, have a lot more oomph these days. Well, that's all the time we have for this item by Spencer Jacob. The Iran relief bounce is this time different. This is your volunteer reader in Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining me for this Tuesday edition of the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona programming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org, the Sun Sounds of Arizona app available from the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store, and you can listen to Sun Sounds programming streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show.